Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995, and the Walter S. Johnson Foundation.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, Republicans try to rebuild their image in California with dynamic races for governor and the U.S. Senate. Could 2010 be their year? And a legacy of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars on the streets of San Diego.
I forget my birthday. I get my kids' birthdays. Like, I can't remember my doctor's appointments. It's difficult for me.
Those stories, plus a guide to the weirdest places in Southern California and a visit to one of them.
One of our most favorite things to do is a freak show. You know, with the midgets and the fire eaters and the lobster people.
Plus what it takes to break a sushi world record for the longest California roll. Break out the wasabi. It's the California Report. Well, California's 2010 primary election is still 6 or 7 months away, but already Republican and Democratic candidates are jockeying for position, especially in the races for governor and the Senate seat held by Barbara Boxer. So first up today, we're joined by Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers to help us sort through the early maneuvering. And John, we might as well start right at the top of the ticket with the governor's race. Arnold Schwarzenegger, of course, prevented from running again next year by term limits, and by far the most interesting race right now is on the Republican side. The matchup, three moderates from Silicon Valley, Meg Whitman, also Steve Poizner and Tom Campbell. Give us a sense of, you know, how you think at this point these three are trying to distinguish themselves from each other.
Well, you know, Scott, I think this is a kind of a three different stories here so far. I'd call it cash, conservatism, and credentials. Meg Whitman, it's really the story so far has been cash. She said that she's willing to spend as much as $150 million on the race for governor once it's all over. That would be a national record for a race other than the presidency. She's already on the air with radio ads across the state. She's got a large and experienced campaign staff. For Steve Poizner, I think the story has been conservatism so far. He's worked the hardest of these three to try and land the party faithful, even though he's not a conservative's conservative. That's been a change for him. And for Tom Campbell, I think it's credentials. It's been this perception that he's enjoyed as the thinking man's candidate, the former business school dean, the guy who's written state budgets and who's held elective office. Both here in Sacramento and in Washington.
There's no question he's got the best resume. And if you look at what Campbell's doing, he's being very specific with how he'd balance the budget. He's outlined specific cuts that he'd support if he gets elected, a very different approach from, say, Whitman. What do you think that says about the two of them and how they're approaching this campaign?
Well, you know, Scott, I think these two campaigns really, Meg Whitman and Tom Campbell, really are, in a way, both about Arnold Schwarzenegger, I think. Tom Campbell was Schwarzenegger's budget director. He knows the details, as you said. He's not shy about saying where even Arnold has gone wrong on the state budget. Whitman, meantime, is running a campaign that's very reminiscent of the Schwarzenegger recall campaign in 2003. That is, refusing to engage in specifics until you have to, avoid those of us in the state political press corps, do national interviews, talk about government overspending in broad, not terribly specific brushstrokes. That's almost the antithesis of the Tom Campbell campaign, but these are really a study in contrast about how you run for governor.
You've got a Republican base that has fallen out of love with Arnold Schwarzenegger in a big way, and you've got three moderates now running. All three support abortion rights. They all support some form of gay rights. Campbell even supports gay marriage. How big a problem is that for these three?
You know, I think it's an important question, and I think it's one we're going to have to watch as time goes on. I mean, Steve Poizner, as I said earlier, I think has worked the hardest to recast himself as a conservative. His campaign aides have even been quoted as saying, you know, well, Poizner's conservative beliefs have grown stronger the more he's been in public life. We know he's the insurance commissioner of California. But if the party faithful are unmoved, I don't think it's inconceivable that a dark horse, very conservative candidate could jump in this race. I mean, the June primary is still a long ways away.
Yeah. On the Democratic side, it really isn't much of a race. Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco, dropped out, leaving only Jerry Brown, who's not even an official candidate. You know, on the one hand, it looks like that's good news for Jerry Brown, but I wonder, do you think in any way, is there a downside for the Democrats or for Jerry Brown getting kind of a free pass to the nomination?
I think there is, and I think you're starting to hear some rumblings, some very quiet rumblings, but rumblings nonetheless among some Democrats about anointing Jerry Brown the winner especially this early. I mean, first and foremost, I think, is which Jerry Brown would Democrats get? I mean, let's not forget the iconic attorney general has not always been so kind to the Democratic Party in the past. Even this week, he was quoted at an event talking about the perils of government regulation, even talking about problems with the state's landmark environmental law, CEQA. Now, that doesn't sound like a Democrat that staunch liberals are going to love. I think being uncontested also makes Jerry Brown a target of Republicans for months.
The other big race, of course, the Senate seat held by Barbara Boxer. She's running for re-election. And yet another Silicon Valley executive, Carly Fiorina, formerly of HP, Hewlett-Packard, she's running for the Republican nomination. What's your impression of her strengths and weaknesses as a candidate?
You know, I think the Fiorina campaign is going to be a great story. I mean, at first blush, her strengths and her weaknesses, I think, really are the same thing. And that's her business experience running Hewlett-Packard. And, you know, Fiorina and gubernatorial candidate Meg Whitman, they both have big-time business credentials. But let's not forget, Meg Whitman left eBay on her own. Carly Fiorina was ousted from HP. Fiorina is more conservative than Whitman, including on some social issues. That could be a problem in a statewide race. But Fiorina versus Barbara Boxer would be a really interesting matchup of strong women who see government very differently. Of course, that is if Carly Fiorina can win the nomination.
And the nomination fight between Fiorina and Assemblyman Chuck DeVore is going to be interesting, too. He's casting himself as the real conservative in the race. He's from Irvine, Orange County. Are we going to see that kind of battle shape up that we've seen in other states where you've got the moderate and the conservative Republicans really going at each other?
You know, I don't think so, Scott. And the reason is there really aren't any moderates left in the California Republican Party. And Carly Fiorina isn't really all that moderate on some of the issues. I think the real question for California Republicans is whether Chuck DeVore, who is a real party faithful kind of guy, whether he can raise his profile enough. Or like with Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2003, will the party gamble on an unknown, even if there's a star quality to them like Carly Fiorina would have?
Well, in the closing seconds here, John, Lieutenant Governor, that job is open with John Garamendi getting elected to Congress last week. We're expecting the governor to name his replacement any day now. What are you hearing?
A lot of names out there, but really the conventional wisdom, I think, still really on two people. Democrat Bob Hertzberg, who is the former Speaker of the Assemblies from L.A., and Republican Abel Maldonado, the state senator from the Central Coast. Hertzberg strikes everybody as a kind of moderate who would probably only hold the job until next year's election, a caretaker lieutenant governor. Maldonado, a bit of a moderate Republican who probably might would want to run for the job himself in 2010. I think the real question is, what will Democrats in the legislature think about any of these? They really do hold the cards because the rules say the legislature can reject the appointment. And so I think it's going to be fascinating to see how Democrats in the legislature react.
All right. Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers, always a pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
As President Obama weighs options for sending more troops to Afghanistan, many California communities are already dealing with the aftermath of that war. In San Diego, the VA Medical Center has enrolled 17,000 veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Almost a third of them are diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, and nearly 10% have traumatic brain injuries, or TBI. Allison St. John of KPBS in San Diego introduces us to one of them, Kenneth Kuntz, a homeless veteran who served in the Iraq War.
Kenneth Kuntz is 27 years old. He has a smooth, almost boyish face with a couple of silver studs in his lower lip. Sitting on the tailgate of his truck in a local strip mall, he shows me his tattoos. The fingers on one hand spell the word love. Hate is displayed across the other, and spidery designs spread from his wrists up his arms.
This is all going to be like hate and all demonic, and this is all going to be like love and heart and all religion and stuff, and it's all becoming to a war on my chest. Like the demons and angels fighting on my chest.
Kuntz is struggling with inner demons. It's been a long road since he was discharged after 6 years in the Navy and 9 months as a border guard with the Army in Iraq. He was born and bred in California, but he's struggling to find his feet again now that he's back home.
I'm still having a hard time. I mean, I've been back for a year and a half. I'm still living in my car.
The back of Kuntz's car is filled with clothes. Everything is immaculately clean, folded, and sorted into piles. A collection of baseball caps is nested neatly, one inside the other.
I'm still military orientated.
Yeah, I mean, look at that.
Fold all my stuff like boot camp style.
Kuntz says he was a good sailor and border guard, but his military career came to an end one day in Iraq during Ramadan.
Well, I got hit by an IED. My friend got blown up right next to me. I got thrown into the front end of the Humvee.
The explosion changed Kunz's life. He was discharged with a personality disorder. Now he goes for regular therapy at the VA Medical Center, but he's not back to his old self.
I get angry really quick now, angrier than I ever really got before, because I don't really think with logic anymore. You know, I have a lot of memory problems. It's hard. Like, I forget names. Like, it's unbelievable. Like, I remember I wasn't ever really that good with names, but, like, I don't even know your name. You know, you've told me it, like, at least four times now. I forget my birthday. I get my kids' birthdays. Like, I can't remember my doctor's appointments. It's difficult for me.
Kunz has been diagnosed with TBI, traumatic brain injury. He also has symptoms of PTSD, unexpected traffic noises set off feelings of panic. Big crowds make him unbearably anxious. After he came home from Iraq, everything fell apart.
It's like a domino effect. Like, I lost everything, you know what I mean? I came back, I pushed everybody out of my life. started using drugs and alcohol to self-medicate. And little by little, I lost my condo, I lost my wife, I lost my kids, I lost my truck. And I was homeless in Santee. That's basically what happened to me.
Kunz's marriage was an early casualty. Counselors at the vet center say the families that succeed after a husband or wife returns from combat are the ones that can open up and talk about what happened to them. Some families become stronger after the separation, but Kenneth Kunz's story is not unusual.
I came back, I lived there, but I just locked myself indoors for the months on end. Just when I came back from Iraq, I was a complete different person. You know what I mean? Like, I'd get drunk and I'd start thinking Iraqis were storming my house.
The VA has no statistics of how many veterans get divorced after they're discharged. They don't have to keep track. Spousal benefits end once a vet leaves active duty. Kunz worries about his children. He has two boys, both under five. He says he feels like they are all he has left. His own parents are separated and he seldom sees them. But Kunz visits his boys whenever he can. His ex-wife is on welfare now. Kunz has been told he could get veterans' disability benefits, but he's still waiting for a check. He's begun to try to make payments from his state disability pay of about $1,200 a month to help her with the kids.
I'm trying to be there for my kids because I wasn't there for the year and a half. I really wasn't there. You know what I mean? Like, when I came back from Iraq, I pushed everything out of my life. And I wasn't there for my kids at all. So I'm trying to be there as much as I can be now.
Kunz takes them to Jack in the Box once in a while for a burger, but he confides sometimes he's afraid of being ambushed in the parking lot. He hopes to land a job soon, but he has a hard time even remembering to keep appointments, and he's worried about his own temper. Kunz has come home from the war, but the tattoos running up his arms reveal the battle inside has not ended. For the California Report, I'm Allison St. John in San Diego.
If you missed something on the show or want to comment on a story you heard, go to our website, californiareport.org. You'll find past shows archived there, and you can sign up for our podcast, too. It's all on our website, californiareport.org, and you'll find us at iTunes as well. Every city or town has its share of odd, off-the-beaten-path stores and restaurants. But for sheer number and range of weird and tacky places, you'd be hard-pressed to top Los Angeles. If you start with the entertainment and porn industries, add institutions like, say, the Church of Scientology, and sprinkle in the vast diversity of cultures found in Southern California, well, you get quite a collection of oddities. Hundreds of them are captured in a new book called L.A. Bizarro. We'll talk with one of its authors in a minute. But first, Deborah Baer takes us to one of these strange places in Hollywood.
Welcome to the CIA, where my friends all come to play. Some of them may have two heads, some of them don't know they're dead.
Hello, my name is Carl Crew, and I'm one of the owners of CIA, that's California Institute of Abnormal Arts. We are kind of a multi-dimensional arts venue, and we have art shows, musical shows every weekend. We have bands, we have burlesque, And one of our most favorite things to do is a freak show. You know, with the midgets and the fire eaters and the lobster people.
Carl Crew and his business partner are former morticians from San Francisco who opened their Hollywood club 14 years ago.
You walk in through these big two gates on the street, and it's a whole area of sideshow installations and artwork, and it's kind of like overload.
Or like an acid trip from Crew's days growing up in Haight-Ashbury during the punk era. He doesn't do drugs anymore, he says, or even booze or cigarettes. But his appetite for the strange hasn't waned.
And we have a circus sideshow museum where we have relics. For example, the head of a Nephilim.
That's Nephilim as in Goliath from the Bible's David and Goliath. The relic looks suspiciously like a gorilla suit head that spent some time with a Hollywood makeup artist.
You know, it's pretty decayed, but pretty good for 2,600 years.
I'll say.
Oh, and this is cool. This is called a pig wah, and it's stuffed, and I got it in Mexico, and it's half a pig and half a chihuahua.
Crew also uses his talent for suspending disbelief in the movie business, acting, writing, and producing. He's done 20 films, including the first one made about Jeffrey Dahmer. But he prefers the comedy horror genre.
This is the dead clown, Achille Chatelier, and he was a disaster clown. Drunk out of his mind every time, and that's what he died of. He died of chronic nephritis, which is liver damage from too much drinking.
As the story goes, Chatelier lived in Michigan a century ago and wanted to be displayed in death as his clown persona. So he was embalmed with mercury and arsenic and hermetically sealed in a glass-covered casket, which Crew protects with a fence so that people don't break it.
So if anything ever happened, I'd have to call hazmat, you know? Yeah, some ugly, ugly poison there.
The CIA and its poisonous dead clown have a devoted following of regulars.
Oh, man, I'm taken back. I am, like, so in awe. This place is just so well put together.
Holly Cost is a professional roller derby skater.
The details are amazing. The colors are bright and wonderful and creepy. And
as creepy as Carl Crew may sound for collecting all of this weirdness, he's actually a pretty nice guy as self-professed oddballs go. A Christian by faith, he draws a clear line between black and white when it comes to the supernatural, which he insists is real and a real occupational hazard.
Because I've been in a lot of very haunted places, and I don't fear it, but I don't want to mess with it. There's been a couple things that we brought in here that had something attached to it, and it got rid of them. You got to be careful. You got to be careful.
For the California Report, I'm Deborah Baer in Hollywood.
There are hundreds more places like that in L.A. Bizarro, the all-new insider's guide to the obscure, the absurd, and the perverse in Los Angeles. Co-author Anthony Lovett picks up our tour, starting with a restaurant in the chain store IKEA in Burbank.
It actually is a great little cafe. It could just be our own little fetish, but the Swedish meatballs and the gravy with the lingonberries and the boiled potatoes on the side are really excellent, and like everything else at IKEA, it's a great value. And I think it's a great surprise to take a date. You know, it may be your last date.
Your last, first and last.
Yeah, but certainly a surprise.
One of the odder eating places, I thought, was the Thanksgiving Day brunch at Hollywood Park Racetrack. Do people actually go there for Thanksgiving?
They do. And I had gone there for Thanksgiving, and that's how I wrote about this. But it's actually very good and a great place to spend Thanksgiving.
Are you up for reading a little bit of that?
Sure.
Put your best announcer voice on.
And they're off. The first out of the gate is ambrosia salad, followed closely by candied yams from hell and grandma's putrid green beans in third. In the middle of the pack gets overcooked turkey, followed by my old Virginia ham, seafood warrior, and soggy stuffing trailing far behind. Still at the gate is cranberry jelly, just turning in circles. At the halfway mark, candied yams from hell holds the lead with overcooked turkey on his trail. But hold the phone. There are two new horses on the track. I can't quite make out the names. It looks like, yes, it's bloated discomfort waddling towards the finish line with tryptophan overdose not far behind. Bloated discomfort is trying to come on strong, unbuttoning its pants and loosening its belt. What it looks like tryptophan overdose is laying down in the middle of the track and, yes, falling asleep.
I was hoping that the folks at the racetrack would read all the way through this to know that we were not referring to their buffet.
That's true. This is the typical Thanksgiving buffet.
Yeah, this is what I grew up with.
You know, for my money, the truly bizarre places start showing up in Chapter 3, which is the conspicuous consumption chapter. You've got the Dapper Cadaver, the Chicken Boy souvenir stand, which sells all things chicken, I guess, the 12-step store. Talk about that grouping of places in that chapter.
A Dapper Cadaver is just a cool store that that sells extremely morbid paraphernalia, which is, you know, great for the goth crowd in Los Angeles. And of course, there's a lot of movie people here too, and it has that kind of gory prop inventory that's perfect for those folks.
And you've got the Sunny Black Dungeon furniture, which has some real practical aspects. There's like a bondage bench that I think turns into a coffee table.
Yeah, he's actually the stuff he makes is incredible. If just to appreciate, even if you're not into the lifestyle, there's some very creative designs and furniture that he makes, and he's a really great guy to talk to as well. And you had mentioned my 12-step store, which I think you only would find in a big city like Los Angeles or maybe New York, where. Anyone who's in the program can go to various locations and pick up the big book and other items having to do with the 12-step program. But this is my 12-step store is sort of the Hollywood version of that, where it's a nice little store. It's in a mall, mini mall. You can pick up underwear that says sober on the imprinted on the butt. And if you want to just skip the whole program and go straight to like a year of sobriety, you can go in and buy like a 1-year chip. And I don't think that's what they intended for, but you can certainly.
You could if you wanted to.
Yeah, you could if you wanted
impress
to.
Impress
right?
your date.
Exactly.
Is there a quintessential kind of bizarre place that for you sums up Los Angeles or Southern California?
It's really tough to pick one. It's such a garden of earthly delights, so it's about sex and food and death.
And Hollywood.
In Hollywood, yeah. So a lot of things do pop into my mind. I mean, I think that you would be hard-pressed to find a gift shop at the coroner's office in any other city. So that comes to mind. Pet cemeteries come to mind. Certainly the cemeteries of the stars where they show movies in the summer, the Cinespia. Series is certainly unique to Los Angeles and very bizarre to be sitting on somebody's grave and watching Peter Sellers in The Party.
When you add all these places up, you know, what do they say to you about Los Angeles and Southern California?
It says that almost anything goes in Los Angeles and that it's an ever-changing landscape. The wrecking ball swings often and quickly in Los Angeles. So maybe it's about the fact that Los Angeles remains constantly bizarre in many ways, but those ways are always changing.
You've lived in L.A., I think, for about 30 years. Do you feel like it's become more or less bizarre in that time?
It's become less bizarre in the sense that it's become gentrified in the same way that, say, Times Square and New York have also been gentrified. It's more bizarre in the ways that it has been gentrified. So the in-your-face marketing of Hollywood and places like Universal City Walk or the sudden preponderance of Pinkberries, the way downtown and Skid Row has been cleaned up and turned into a kind of tourist attraction there's, you know, diners that kind of play off the what was once and still is a really sad area. In some ways, it's not as bizarre in a historical way, but in other ways, it's even more bizarre because you just don't know what's gonna pop up next.
Anthony Lovett, he along with Matt Moranian are co-authors of L.A. Bizarro, the all-new insider's guide to the obscure, the absurd, and the perverse in Los Angeles. Tony, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Sushi lovers can't get enough California roll, that popular West Coast concoction of avocado, crab, cucumber, and rice wrapped in seaweed. Now, imagine a California roll longer than a football field. A group of UC Berkeley students did exactly that recently, creating a California roll more than 100 yards long, setting a new world record in the process. The event celebrated the 50th anniversary of the school's Center for Japanese Studies, and Sarus Farivar brings us this postcard.
Tuck, tuck, roll. All right, get in, get ready. You're going to start tucking soon. Good job. Tuck, get all the air pockets out, and slowly roll with your right hand. Going like a wave.
Ming Wong is one of the chefs on hand from Slippery Fish Sushi Catering. He's helping the nearly 500 students who are lined up along one side of a series of connected tables. Across from them, he and the other chefs work the line, handing out ingredients and giving instructions.
Tuck, tuck with your left hand. Tuck, tuck, tuck. Roll over. Tuck, tuck, tuck. Roll it over. Come towards me. Ready? One, two, three. Beautiful, beautiful. Okay, we're good. We're good over there.
California rolls are made inside out. That is, with the rice on the outside and the nori, or dried seaweed, on the inside. Then, there's three main ingredients that go in the middle: crab meat, cucumber, and avocado.
Because of the sun, it's making the nori shrink a lot faster, and the moisture of the rice makes the nori shrink. But we're able to overcome that, and everybody's able to figure out exactly how to fix those challenges.
And without missing a beat, Wong goes back to working the line, one student at a time.
A little lighter, a little lighter. Finesse, finesse. You don't want to muscle anything. It's only rice and avocado and crab.
It's been said that the California roll was created in a Los Angeles sushi restaurant in the 1960s. It's not really authentically Japanese at all, says Professor Duncan Williams, the head of the Center for Japanese Studies.
This is a California invention and a kind of hybrid Japanese or fusion Japanese cuisine that's become popularized in California. And since the current record was set in Hawaii, our aim is to bring that record back to Cal, as it were, and do it right here on the UC Berkeley campus.
Almost there.
3 hours later, all that tucking and rolling paid off. To certify the results, the university had on hand Consul General Yasumasa Nagamine. After walking the entire 330 feet, he made his pronouncement.
330 feet long California roll has been done. Beautifully.
And with that, all 330 feet of the California roll was quickly devoured, although much more quickly than it was made. For the California Report, I'm Sarus Farivar in Berkeley.
And we've got photos of the record-breaking California roll. Sample them at our website, californiareport.org. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our directors this week are Erica Kelly and Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical producer. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. Our interns are Susanna Kim, Mike Lee, Nicole Ely, Matthew Richmond, and Alice Daniel. Gabriel Cohen is our online editor. The producer is Victoria Maleone. Dan Brecky was a contributing editor. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. Chevron, an energy company encouraging innovation right here in California. This is the power of human energy. Information available at chevroncalifornia.com. And the California Endowment, working to build healthier communities that support children, youth, and families. Online at www.calendow.org.